An intrepid traveller accepts a wager to circumnavigate the globe in 80 days or less. Mm. But of course, the adventures and scrapes of Phileas Fogg found himself caught up in were all made up stories. So what would happen if a real life person went on a real life journey following Phileas's route? Well, that's what Phil Hill from Bath did. And amongst other highlights, he found himself the only passenger on board a container ship crossing the Pacific and being met by soldiers who then deported him from Belarus. Oh, and he didn't need the full 80 days either. Phil Hill is with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Simon. How are you?
Really good, thank you. It's nice to have you here, although you're not here. We said you're from Bath, but actually you also spent a bit of your time in somewhere far more glamorous.
Yes, it has its moments. I'm in Greece at the moment, in the Dodecanese Islands. I'm not sure how to say the name of the island to give it away. The people here probably wouldn't appreciate it.
No, but it sounds lovely. Quick weather update. Is it gorgeous there?
Strangely enough, it's been fantastic for the last week or so. Swimming every day. But today we've had some wind come in and it's going to get much worse tomorrow. So you may be having better weather than we have in Greece right now. Over the next couple of days.
Yeah. I'm looking out the window and seeing the sunshine, so I'm just going to say no, and move on. So look, I read the book, and what an interesting idea. And the first question I was going to ask you before I read the book was, why did you decide to embark on this adventure? Although, to be honest, having read the book, I'm not sure you knew either.
No, I didn't. And I've asked myself that question many times, actually. Why, in the middle of doing it, why am I doing this? But it was just a sort of madcap idea that came to me, having read, as you said in your introduction, about Jules Verne's book, Around the World in 80 Days. And I read it one summer, and I just thought to myself, I wonder if that's still possible. So I then researched it a bit, clearly not enough, and then decided to give it a shot. And I set myself the target of 70 days.
And the rules were the same as Phileas's rules. So planes weren't allowed. He did a lot of sort of boat travel. You did some boat travel. You did an awful lot of trains. And I've got to be honest, as I was reading the book, and you virtually as soon as you started your journey, it sounded like, I'm just going to turn around and go home again. Because within like 3 days, you were traveling by train, uncomfortable, cold, and then deported.
Yes, I'm sitting on a minibus in Belarus, and there's 8 guards in the minibus with me. They've just hauled me off a train, and they're taking me to the middle of I don't know where, actually. And I was saying to myself, what am I doing here? Why am I in this situation? I've travelled so much and never got into these kind of pickles. So it went through my mind, but having got through the worst of it, which was day 3 and day 4, I never really considered turning back after that, but certainly on day 3, I really nearly gave it all up. My preparation was inadequate, and that's putting it mildly.
And this was all to do with, it was a sort of a passport and a visa issue, ultimately.
The fact I needed, even though I was going to take this train from Berlin to Moscow, I travelled through Poland and then got to Belarus, and I didn't realise I needed a Belarusian transit visa. The crazy thing was that the border guard stamped me through, and I thought, oh, I've got away with that. And then I could hear them running down the train towards me. And sure enough, they came in, cancelled my entry visa in my passport, grabbed my luggage and hauled me off the train. It was all a bit of a blur at the time because I didn't see it coming. But there we go, you know, through adversity, we survive and we move on.
Well, you did, but, you know, day 3 and you're under armed guard. You know,
yes, basically, yeah.
But now, the rest of the journey, and it's really interesting, because when we knew you were coming on and when we knew about what you'd done, I was thinking, oh, it's going to be stopping off in amazing places, having amazing experiences here, there and everywhere. I'd sort of forgotten about the time it takes to travel from these places. So you spent a whole week on the Trans-Siberian Railway. Firstly, with a very poorly travelling companion, but secondly, just being on a train for that long, where every now and again you could get off for a couple of minutes, but that was it.
Well, the week on the Trans-Siberian paled into insignificance compared to crossing the Pacific Ocean, which was like more than 20 days. You certainly can't get off those container ships, and the Atlantic Ocean afterwards. But the thing with the Trans-Siberian was I sort of went on there with this misconception that I was going to be entering the Orient Express. You know, I saw myself in the middle of a sort of Agatha Christie novel. Got on there, and there are no washing facilities other than a sort of metal basin. You certainly don't get a shower. There certainly isn't five-star dining or anything like that. So sort of within a few hours of being on there, I realised that camping was probably more favourable than actually being on the Trans-Siberian from a luxurious perspective. From the perspective of what you see and the sights and the places that you pass through, it's absolutely spectacular. So I can't knock that at all. And it was a real eye-opener, I mean, the whole of the journey on there. Plus, as you mentioned, I had a sick travelling companion. We got to about day five, I think it was, and the guard on the train told us we basically had to get off. We were in the middle of Siberia. We're in the middle of nowhere. I had no idea where we were. So that was a tough call, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all the way through the book, you kind of go on, and I hate using the word journey in this case, but there's no other word for it, because it was a physical journey, but also it was an emotional journey. And one of the biggest bits that affected you the most was, as you mentioned, the cargo ship. Now, you travelled on a cargo ship, which is, I didn't even know you could do that as a passenger, for starters. And you prepared for it by putting lavender oil behind your ears.
I did. I mean, the thing is that crossing the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic, actually, I was on two different cargo ships for those two journeys. I was the only passenger on both. I didn't know that you could book a passage either. I was looking for cruise liners so I could have the time of my life. But the time of year I was going, there weren't any. So it was like, OK, I'm going to have to find another way. And I hit upon this idea of getting on board a cargo ship. And I think you can still do it now, but most of these ships have got two or three cabins, which are sort of reserved for the owners and maybe their friends, although quite why any of them would want to spend 20 days crossing the Pacific, I'm not sure. So I managed to book a passage on both ships, but I was the only passenger. And, of course, I went on there thinking, well, I'm going to get seasick and this is going to happen. And, again, it was nothing, again, like I had expected. Preparation, and I fouled miserably on all three occasions.
Well, thank goodness, because otherwise the book wouldn't be half as interesting.
No,
the preparation that you did take was the lavender oil behind your ears, because that is apparently good for seasickness, although, like you say, it was the Atlantic crossing where the proper waves came.
Yeah, much worse. I mean, I didn't get seasick, and fortunately, I've never been seasick. A few years later, I was crossing the Drake Passage down to Antarctica, and there was a lot of people not enjoying the ride. But again, I wasn't seasick. But it was a really interesting time across the Pacific. I mean, I can't say, someone asked me, would you do it again? It's like, well, in the context of the journey I was making, it was necessary. I can't say I'd do it again, but it really was the most sort of eye-opening within myself. I don't want to use the word journey, although I just did. But it really was a moment of real inward reflection, spending all that time alone on there. And I think it was the thing I got the most from.
You said how much more relaxed you looked. So, you know, clearly it worked, even though not necessarily
it
from
did.
First glance you would have thought it would.
Yeah, it did. I mean, putting aside any stresses that came with some of the elements of the journey, like in Belarus, I came back really, I can say, it sounds very dramatic, I don't mean it to be that way, but it really did affect me and change me a lot. It made me a much more open person. I did so much inward reflection that, you know, the course of my normal life, I just wouldn't have done. And so I opened myself up to myself, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. And in a floating hotel prison.
In a floating hotel prison. Yes, indeed. But you were right, sorry, about the Atlantic, because it was much rougher on the Atlantic. I wasn't allowed on deck, you know. I think on one occasion I was allowed on deck. But so you literally are in a floating tin box.
Yeah. And again, for, you know, your 60-odd days around the world, what with the train and what with the boats, you know, half of that time was spent not being able to get out into the real world.
No, that's right. Even with the trains, I mean, they'd stop at a station and you might get out for 20 minutes or half an hour. But that was it. So in the times when I wasn't doing the sort of heavier part of the journey, I did try to see a few places that I hadn't been to before, like Berlin, for example. I spent some time there, Shanghai, also Hong Kong, Chicago. So I made a point that along the route, I would try to spend some sort of downtime, if you like, and get out and meet people. Although on the trains, actually, you do get to meet people, especially going across America. That was a really nice experience.
It sounds like every step of the way there were interesting people and there were interesting things, like you say, through the windows of the trains and even the boat. You saw a whale through the window of a ship.
Oh, yeah. You see dolphins, you see whales. You don't see many other ships. I mean, in the days of Phileas Fogg, fictional as he was, there were ships plying those trades almost every day. Nowadays, it's like every 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Although I don't know, with the current economic situation, I should think every vessel that can carry cargo is moving at the moment. But so you do see nature. I saw the most amazing sunsets. It was incredible, rainbows, and really, of course, you can see all this stuff on dry land, but you can't see the sunsets that I was seeing out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It was incredible.
Highlight of the journey?
People have asked me about highs and lows, and I quite often reflect that something that was a high at the time appeared like a low afterwards. So I had a bit of a romantic adventure in Mexico, which at the time seemed like a high. Afterwards, it turned into a real disastrous low. You'd have to read the book to know the details of that one. But, you know, and then things that were lows, you know, on reflection, like even that time in Belarus, I can look at it as a real low point, the point at which I nearly turned back. But now I can think of it as a high because I gained a certain amount of strength from it, you know, and it let me face other adversities that happened along the way in a much easier, in an easier mental condition, if you like. So I see, I've just looked back on the Belarus experience as a high now. Although it definitely was a low. Some of the people I met, I would say, were highs, and they're usually the people that, you know, when you first meet them, you don't have any kind of expectation of how things might go. I met a couple on a family actually on a train going down to Shenzhen, on the China-Hong Kong border, and it was just wonderful. You know, I think about them all the time, and they were family. I didn't speak the language, but I still remember holding their little baby. They were thrusting their little baby in my arm so they could take photos. Probably hadn't seen an Englishman before.
Well, as you quite rightly pointed out, it could have been the only time that the baby was held by an Englishman because we then had COVID, which changed the world again. But you took you a while to write this up. You kept a few diaries along the way.
Yes.
And you obviously knew it was always going to be a story that you needed to tell, but it took you a while to revisit it. When you did, to look back on just doing it, just, you know, so many of us say, right, let's do something fun and never get around to it. I guess to look back would be quite a lovely thing.
It was, you know, at the time, and perhaps a little bit since, I haven't really sort of appreciated the enormity of what I did. I mean, anybody could do it, but, you know, to make yourself actually go out there and do it. I took a bit of time. I kept a handwritten journal from the whole journey. And I was reflecting on whether I should write the story or not. And a few people said to me, go on, do it. And I just kind of put it off. I was involved in other things and other travels. And then COVID hit and we couldn't travel anywhere. And I revisited my diary. And it was like, okay, I've now got a few months where I can't do anything. I'm going to sit down and write this story or see if I can write this story. And it just brought back such amazing memories to me, and you know, I got out my photographs and started reviewing them, and anecdotes of things that happened started to just flood back to me. And I have to say, I mean, everyone talks about writing as being quite a complicated process. It just flowed. I couldn't stop once I'd started. Absolutely loved it.
Well, I tell you, my favourite thing in the book is the fact that you had to so many times, whether it be to customs people, border crossing, even getting your visas in the first place, you had to explain to them that you were what you were doing in this adventure you were going on, and all these bemused officials going, I'm sorry, what are you doing again?
Yeah, the craziest one was the American Embassy in London. I mean, I went there because if you arrive on... We don't need a visa, ordinarily, British citizens, but... if you arrive on a boat, strangely enough, you do need a visa. So I went to the embassy, said I need a visa. They said, no, you don't. I explained, I'm arriving on a cargo ship. It's like, do you work on it? No, I don't. Okay. I mean, it just threw them into total confusion. Finally, after like the third or fourth person that came along to talk to me, someone said, why are you doing this? And I said, have you read the book by Jules Verne? And he said, yes. And that was it. Stamp, visa, no problem. So, yeah, he got it. Let's put it like that.
Well, a lovely thing to say, right, I'm going on an adventure and then actually doing it. Hats off to you. The book is a really good read. It's called Phileas Phil, Around the World in 65 Days. It tells the real adventure of Phil Hills, following in the footsteps of the fictional Phileas Fogg from Jules Verne's book. Thank you, Phil. Nice to meet you. And sorry the weather's taking a turn now. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Send you some sunshine. My pleasure. Thank you so much.